This is a Triple J podcast.
Having an erotic experience that I'm giving myself permission to be as like wild as my brain wants to make it. It doesn't make you a bad feminist for being into that fantasy.
Hello and welcome to the Hookup Podcast, where we talk all things love, sex, dating and relationships. I'm your host, Dee Salmon, and every Thursday I go a bit deeper with someone on either a chat that Pip and I had with you on the Tuesday pod, or maybe a chat where you send us a DM with a question that you need help with and I find someone to answer your questions, or maybe it's someone who I think has a great book that's out and I think you'll love it. But in today's episode, we're going to keep the conversation going about what kind of porn you're into. If you haven't already listened to our Tuesday ep, it's called What Kind of Porn Are You Into? And you can find it in your feeds. But basically, we just heard from you about all the different types of stuff that you're watching, you're listening to, and you're reading to get off. Like, what turns you on? And we heard about how you felt about that, whether it was something that you were into in real life, or maybe it was just a fantasy, or if this was something that you had a lot of shame around. So, you know, things from hentai porn to gay porn, BDSM, things like rope, rough sex, piss play, consensual, non-consensual. And I thought we definitely need to take this conversation a bit deeper and find out why we might be into certain things. Is it just a fantasy, or is there a deeper meaning? When is it problematic, and when can it impact your real life? And also, we're going to get some advice on how to deal with the shame that you might be carrying about what you're into. So yeah, just a bit of a heads up, we will be talking about rough sex and non-consensual sex and fetishization. So I'll put some resources in the show notes if that brings up anything for you. But here to have the chat now is good friend of the show, sexologist Lauren French. Hello, Lauren, and thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me, as always.
This is a huge topic.
It is indeed.
So I'm conscious of the fact that we only have, you know, the classic 30 minutes to chat. But let's kind of see where this leads and what we can get into. Something that Pip and I discussed in the last episode was we unpacked a little bit about the main reasons people consume porn. You know, things like fantasy, to offload stress, to get like dopamine hits, education, see if it's something that they're into. What have you found through the work that you do are the main reasons that people consume porn?
Yeah, all of those things. I think one of the biggest reasons, particularly when we think about like masturbation, self-pleasure, exploration of self, there's also a real, almost like a fast food view of pornography sometimes, that it's like the quick, easy way to like get to an orgasm, or, you know, indulge in some self-pleasure is just, oh, I'm just gonna like watch porn and that'll be like the quick, fast thing, versus like, oh, if I was just gonna go off fantasy, oh, I have to take time, I have to think about the fantasy, do I have the time for that? And so often it's viewed as like the quick way to get to the outcome, which is often an orgasm, which is a stress reliever, which is a distraction technique, which is a, you know, way to fill a day that is maybe getting a little bit boring. Or it's also a space that is used, as you said, for education, particularly for LGBTQIA plus young people that maybe have had zero sex ed that actually is relevant to the kind of sex that they want to have. And so they're actually using that both maybe as an erotic kind of pleasurable tool, as well as like, oh, that's how that works. That's how that can look.
Yeah, we're going to get into that, because we had a few listeners who are queer and trans said that that was the reason that they were consuming certain types of porn. But I want to, hear a little bit more about like that quick, fast takeaway food type porn. Are people watching things that they'd never really be into in real life, or like what are they consuming?
Yeah, and this is where we kind of look at the difference between fantasy and desire. So often when you look at kind of research or just like this space, desire is often thought about as the things we want to do. What do you desire? What do you want out of a partner, out of a experience, out of, you know, whatever it is? What am I wanting? Versus fantasy is fantasy. Sometimes we might desire the same things we're fantasizing about. We have a fantasy we want to reenact. We have something we fantasize about that we'd love to happen in real life. And then there are things that we fantasize about because they are erotic, and we do not want to experience them in real life. So there are things that we might fantasize about that are erotic purely because they are a bit taboo, they are a bit outside of our normal experience, they just sit under an erotic umbrella. And in our brain we go, oh, that's erotic, that's sexy, that's taboo. And so when I fantasize about that, I feel erotic and sexy, and I get to go into that space. And in the fantasy of that, that's really safe. I have control over that fantasy. I have control of what's happening, what the outcome is, versus if something like that was happening in real life, maybe I wouldn't have that control, and therefore it is not enjoyable. Therefore, I do not want it. So there's that difference between desiring what I want to do and fantasizing about fantasy stuff.
Exactly. It's like when we think about anime, which we're going to get into, it's like that you're not going to be able to really fuck a dragon or a tentacle. You know what I mean? It's like,
there is a great tentacle dildo you can get that does have like eggs in it that like deposit into you. Yeah. So look, always dream a dream. But yeah, there are spaces where people have particularly like fetishes and kinks that are actually just not possible in real life. And having fantasy, having, whether it's pornography, whether it's like sometimes the like VR stuff where you get to experience things that you would just never be able to, whether it's like erotic literature, whether it's audio erotic stuff, like these are ways that we're able to experience things that we, that are not possible.
What is keeping people from exploring things? You mentioned a bit there, like the safeness and the control. Mm. Do you think it's kind of like, you know, sometimes I wonder like, oh, if we didn't have the quote-unquote rules and structures we had in society, like what would people be like if it was a bit, you know, release your inner inhibitions? Like, is there some underlying deeper meaning about what you might be finding erotic?
Oh, I mean, there's so many layers of the sexual onion that we'll call a fantasy. Because for some people, yeah, like you might have fantasies about giving up control, being fully, you know, whether it's a submissive fantasy, whether it is like a non-consensual consent fantasy that you're having, because actually I just want to give up control. I just want to, in that moment, actually want and desire what's happening. But I want to like just hands off the wheel, have someone completely take control in that moment. And that might be why I'm having that fantasy. That might be driven because of the real world environment that I'm in. That might be driven just because like I've read a lot of BDSM like erotic literature, and that's just an exciting idea for me. So that's what I want to do. There's definitely a lot of, you know, research correlation around different people's past experiences and how they can then use fantasy to help take ownership back. So for example, for some victim survivors of abuse and violence, they can find that control and autonomy in fantasy really helpful, and actually can be part of healing journeys for some individuals. Now, I'm not saying that's for everyone, and that doesn't mean any person who's experienced that harm is going to do that. But fantasies are as like unique as people, and the reasons we have them are super unique as well.
Like, I think we've spoken about it previously on the hookup, where you, because there's so such extreme stuff and you start at such a young age, say, for example, that like you end up just getting into more and more.
Well, you're unique, trying to find your next high.
Yeah, like unique, specific, very specific things to get aroused. And you're like, how did I get here? But it's yeah, tell us about like the what's happening in the brain of why sometimes it takes like a very specific thing for you to be able to like orgasm.
Yeah, because often what the pathway we're developing in our brain and like what we're trying to do is like we're building the habit of something extreme that is like taboo and erotic because it's extreme and because it's taboo is the really exciting thing. But like if you watch that same thing after a while, it's no longer exciting. It's no longer new. And so in a similar way that, you know, we're trying to find that next high, we're trying to go, well, what's that next level extreme? Because I'm not getting that same dopamine hit. I'm not getting that same hit of almost adrenaline of, well, this is like so taboo, and actually that's what I'm finding sexual pleasure in. It's not necessarily the action that's happening. It's that we view that action as taboo. The tabooness is what is desirable about it. And so it's interesting when you were kind of talking about, you know, if we lived in a society that didn't have maybe the shame around sex, to an extent, some of that shame that creates the like erotic pleasure, because like the reason I'm into that is because it's like taboo.
That's so true.
So if like nothing was taboo, then like what's the sexy taboo thing?
That's so true. That is fascinating, because I think it is a huge part of it. And there would be people as well who have become so niche into what they're into that it's changed and impacted the way that they have sex now, right? Like they can't maybe have certain sex without watching that specific thing or being into having that thing to get them aroused.
Yeah, in really similar ways that people will tell me, you know, like in clinical practice or in, you know, other spaces, hey, I can only orgasm this one position, this one way with this one thing. And often the view is like, oh, there's like a broken thing there, or oh, there's something wrong. No, you've just trained your body to do a thing. We've like trained our body, hey, this is the position, this is what I'm doing, and this is what I'm watching. And these are the cues that my body takes to go, oh, it's like time now. In the same way that, you know, when you're, you know, in a relationship or when you're, you know, being intimate with someone, the way your like body might clock that is, oh, if I like wear this particular outfit, like this is my signal to my partner that I'm like really interested in fucking tonight. And in a way though, putting that on, being in that position, that's my body getting into the habit of what I'm building. So when I'm doing the same thing with pornography, no matter what kind of it is, again, I'm training my body. This is the way we get aroused. Mm. I think even I've talked about this here before, about the difference between like spontaneous and responsive like desire and arousal. And what you're actually kind of starting to do is you're not having spontaneous arousal often because you're not actually that horny in the moment. You're going, okay, I'm going to do this thing and I'll put the pornography on and then I'm getting aroused. And so what you're doing is actually you're doing the responsive desire piece, but not to your partner, not to like the moment that it's happening. You're doing it in a way of going, oh, I'm using it as a tool. I'm not waiting to actually be turned on.
That's so fascinating. It's interesting. I feel like there's, yeah, like you said, there's so much depth to this, the sex onion of why certain people are into certain things.
Yeah. And there's like societal, social norm stuff about it as well, where like certain like fetishes, quote unquote, get often like a lot of high traction, again, because there's societal shame or there's stigma around it. And so that creates the taboo excitement. And so if I'm like, oh, I'm wanting something like really like out there, really exciting, you know, this stuff, you know, it feels a little bit boring now, I'm going to gravitate towards that because socially we've decided that is unusual.
I want to chat about some of the most popular porn that listeners said that they liked. We'll start with gay porn because of Heated Rivalry.
Love it.
So you didn't watch it, you said, but
I haven't watched it yet.
You haven't watched it yet, but you've read the books.
I have read the books.
Okay, what did you think?
Love. I mean, it's a genre I quite love. I'm as someone who is very self-proclaimed not a sporty person, give me a male-on-male hockey romance, absolutely any day of the week. Like, can I tell you much about hockey? No, not at all. But that is like, there's something about the books that are hockey romances that just like hit different. Not going to lie. It's a personal favorite of mine. So absolutely love how popular it is at the moment and how it's like completely gotten into mainstream spaces.
Oh, it's so fascinating. We did a whole episode on it and we explored that there's so many straight women or women that are really into it. Why do you think that is? I think people are surprising themselves by watching it and being like, oh my God, now I want to watch gay porn.
That's so funny to me almost as a question because I go, obviously straight women are into it. If women are straight, they like men and they like very, like they might like really like male images. You're watching two men being erotic and sexy and sensual and all the things. Like it's kind of very much for, in a way, the straight gaze, as much as it also is for gay male gazers. Like it's very enjoyable because actually it's for straight women. It's what we desire and also in a very safe way. Like it's a really safe, you know, piece because it's actually we get to be the observers of this erotic experience that we're not a part of, but we get to enjoy how that looks for them.
In the episode when we unpacked this a bit and heard from listeners talking about how they really like queer porn or gay porn, Pip shared how her ex said that it was quote unquote kind of gay for her to like watching girls masturbate. What do you think about this idea and when people kind of say like, ooh, like why are you into queer porn if you identify as straight, like? And this idea that, oh, it means that you're not really straight and you might be, you know, exploring your sexuality.
Yeah, to those people I would say, not sure you understand sexuality as a whole, as like an idea or like an experience, a human experience. I'd also say then to any like, particularly like any straight men watching porn that have men in it, does that make you gay?
I don't know. You're like,
probably not.
You're watching a guy with a, you know.
I know, like there's a dick on screen. What's going on? No, you're watching like something that is literally made and designed to be erotic. That's its whole purpose. Its whole purpose is to be erotic, is to be entertaining, is to turn you on in a lot of ways. And so it's not always necessarily about body parts. I think people get very attached, which I do understand, where their sexuality is so rooted in this idea of I'm only attracted to a set of body parts that are kind of like, it's not actually about faces and people. It's just I'm attracted to breasts and vulvas, or I'm attracted to dicks and balls. Not to use medical for one and not the other. But a lot of actually brains and humans, we're not that categorical in our desires and actually also in our enjoyment of erotic things. It's actually just someone being erotic, being experiencing pleasure that is erotic to watch. And when we think of sexuality, there's something very different about here's like the things I enjoy watching and enjoy and being part of my like personal erotic self. And that's very different than I want to engage sexually with someone. That's like very different. That's actually a very different personal experience. It's a very different human experience. And so I can enjoy, you know, two women kissing, but I would enjoy kissing a woman. But for a lot of people, you can enjoy this because in the same way that I can like watch a movie about something I have no interest in doing, but enjoy watching it because it's entertaining and because it's fun.
Which is, I think, what Heated Rivalry was for so many people.
And also, like, the thing I love about Heated Rivalry, and I know what's been talked a lot about, is also the, like, mundaneness of, like, queer love and sex and intimacy that isn't what it is constantly done in most mainstream media under this cloth of hardship and despair and difficulty and rejection, both socially and from family. Like, it was actually a space where it was, in a way, was treated like a mainstream straight couple.
That is exactly how the rom-com would have been written if it was a hetero rom-com or even just like a Bridgerton episode.
Yeah.
A lot of our listeners said that they were into trans porn, which was something that we explored. Sam sent us a DM and said that it was a way for them to explore their gender and transness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So whether it's trans or gay porn, how common is consuming this content as a way to discover your sexuality or gender?
I think it's very common because, you know, for a lot of people that don't have a lot of, you know, trans representation in their everyday life versus their media that isn't either pornography and sex work or isn't like, you know, there's so much media conversation, rightly so, about how trans representation in media is often just about like killing prostitutes and in every movie and TV show, and it's always hardship and difficulty, or it's sex work and it's very hypersexualized. And so for some people, yeah, that's their only experience of being able to understand that that's an option for them, that that is a place that they can sit in themselves, in the world. And so in the same way, for a lot of people that aren't cis and straight, pornography is an opportunity to see what is out there. I would say that, you know, like, the biggest, I think, concern is as well sometimes people that are consuming trans porn that are then going into their real worlds, having relationships with trans women, but having so much shame and stigma around what that is viewed at that it becomes so dangerous for trans women. And there's such a risk of violence for the trans women because of the view that that makes them gay. Or that makes that other person gay, or like that it becomes such, again, question on sexuality about body parts.
Yeah, I feel like, I don't know if we had this DM for this episode, but I feel like I've heard from people before who were like, I'm into this. Does that mean, like, what does this mean? And like, there is that guilt and shame.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also wonder, we spoke about it in the episode, like the intent of what you're watching, because cultural context matters, right? So when does porn with different races or trans porn become fetishization or cause harm?
Yeah. I think that word you've used is so important, intent. Like, what's the intent of it? And is the intent of the pornography that someone's in to dehumanize them and to make them an object and to really, you know, have their, whether it's their transness or whether it's a racial identity or whatever it is, that's the only reason they're there and that's the whole purpose of it, because that becomes fetishization. Then it's, you've dehumanized that individual and you've just categorically put them in a box and that's the only reason why it's there. Versus if you're watching something that just, you know, is a particular trope that you quite enjoy and there's different, you know, racial representations in there, or you're, you know, enjoying a particular porn star, but you enjoy them for reasons that aren't just because they are trans or Asian or black or whatever it is, then we're stepping less into that space. But it's a really big risk. And, you know, I think it's something where it gets very normalized, the fetishization of particularly minority groups. As, you know, I'm a Chinese Aboriginal person. When I remember when I was at like uni going out, which is 100 million years ago now, but I used to have these guys come up to me thinking it was so cool to tell me that they had yellow fever and they wanted to get with me because they had yellow fever, fetishizing my Asian heritage as if that was like going to turn me on in a club.
That is fucked, Lauren.
And I can tell you, never been drier in my life. Like, it's just not it. But how normalized that fetishization was, because actually that person wasn't seeing me as anything other than Asian and tick box of that's what I like.
Where's the crossover that porn plays? Because if you look at Pornhub's top 10 most watched porn, it is, so much of it is race.
Yeah. And I think it's really difficult because from a porn website-y kind of space, like they're giving in of what's popular, but they're also feeding an algorithm of here's the things that are popular and here's what you should be watching. And also, you know, then I would be very curious, because I'm a bit of a data nerd at times, of how many of those videos under like Asian is purely the fetishization of an Asian person versus just happens to be an Asian person, but actually it's not actually relevant to the video or to the storyline or to the action. And so I think on these online platforms, so often the issue actually becomes is that you have to pick category. Like, you know, what would it look like if the categories had to be around experience versus individual? But I think that would be in a completely different paradigm shift of how we're currently viewing and consuming it. I don't think it'd be a bad shift, because I think it's very easy to not intentionally go into fetishize, but end up in that space because, you know, you've built a neural pathway and habit that's what turns you on.
And the platform's made that so accessible.
Yeah.
It's like the chicken or the egg, you know?
Yeah. And I think that's why, you know, the reason I harp on about data so often is because it's really actually difficult to name what's causing versus what's just happening because it's so cyclical.
What about hentai? Because this was the number one most watched porn type category on Pornhub for 5 years.
Yeah.
And I was so shocked to find this out. I had no idea. Mm. I've never really dabbled. Pete knows more about anime than I do. Why do you think this is so popular?
I think I can't speak to all of the reasons, because I think there's so many interconnected reasons, whether it's because it's linked to the anime that people are consuming and is super popular. A big piece I think that's actually playing out is in the same way that like cartoon, hentai, any sort of animated level of porn kind of sits in, is the safeness of the fantasy, because it's not quote unquote real world people that you're watching. And so there's an element of, well, actually I can be as absolutely like wild as I want because someone's drawing it for me. And like, there's a safeness of that in the same way that I also think you can get quote unquote more and more extreme. And so if I'm again trying to chase that high of what's that next taboo thing, hentai allows a lot more space for that. And then I also think, again, going back to that like causation, correlation, like what's causing it. So often a normal like developmental practice in our youth, like when we think about puberty, when we think about young people, is around kind of going to extremes, not necessarily because it turns them on or because it's a direct like sexual link, but because like developmentally there's a thing in the brain of, I want to know what's like the biggest thing, what's the most babies that have ever been had, what's the biggest dick that's ever been had, what's the this sort of thing, and that gets them into these extreme pathways. And then the conversation is often like, what's the extreme thing we can use as a joke? So hentai is the joke, hentai is the thing I get to pull to because that's an extreme like sex thing. And again, it normalizes it as the taboo that I reach to if I want a taboo.
Especially like you said, when it's cartoon or drawn, it's like you can literally draw and make up whatever scenario you want, which is why when you talk about the extreme thing, I think a lot of it from what I've seen is parts where women are very like childlike and perfect and like massive boobs and perfect waist and massive butt. And it's like can kind of draw the most quote unquote perfect woman.
Yeah. Well, can I tell you, this is a very tangenty, but my favorite anime that I'd ever seen, that I actually hadn't watched, a friend showed me a clip of it, and I just thought it was the funniest thing, was exactly as you talked about, tiny waist, kind of like decent butt, but like huge breasts. Absolutely. Just like this person couldn't, I don't think, function as an actual human if they were like put in the real world, like their body would break. But it was like some zombie something, some or like a shooting kind of anime. And there was like this person with a gun and this woman with these huge breasts like leaned back and a gunshot, and her right breast lifted up and the bullet went past before the left. But it was like the bullet went through her breasts as they were moving. And like, honestly, there was something very cinematic about it. It was quite entertaining. But that's a perfect example of this leaning into this hyper feminine, hyper-sexualized, hyper view of women in these animated spaces, and also the fact that they're hyper-sexualized and often very much leaning towards a younger image.
And what kind of impact does that have in real life for people? Because it's like, you know, we had people DM say, I'm into really rough, violent sex. Guys saying they like to watch that about women, or if they're watching hentai, and like you, like we've been discussing, it's like that childlike, massive boobs, perfect woman, maybe even non-consensual. Like, what implications does this have watching or consuming that kind of porn?
I'm going to do something so annoying, which is not give an answer. But the reason I'm going to do this, I'm going to talk about the fact that I think there's a really easy jump that we make around the pornography we watch is a direct correlation to the actions that we do. And I think for some people that's true. I think there's definitely impacts, but I also think pornography, particularly popular free pornography that people consume, is just a snapshot of the world and the like norms that we've allowed in the world. So if there's like a huge amount of barely legal girls, non-consensual, you know, pornography, a lot of time it's because that's the normalized world we've created of what is attractive and what should be kind of reached for. But then when you actually do, and I highly recommend people, you know, if you're a data-y nerd like me at times, to look at the different Australian research that have gone out there, it's very inconclusive. It's actually, particularly if you look about people that are consuming quote-unquote violent pornography, about what impact that has on them in their behaviours. Again, I'm not to say it doesn't have it at all. It's just actually really difficult to piece it out. There's a real lack of research that shows a clear, here's the thing that causes the thing. Also because when research is done, what gets put under violent pornography is really different. Because like if it was under a BDSM kind of label and it's a consensually created, like kink focused, but there's lots of like violence in that, but it's violence that has been consensually orchestrated, discussed and, you know, agreed upon, then that is still put under violent in the same way that a non-consensual video would as well. And so they're put under the same category, and then that's really difficult in the same way that like pornography with spanking, different people would put that under different levels of violence. And so all of these categories just make it really difficult to create a complete line. What I would say, because that's not a fun answer, what I would say for particularly like listeners and young people, if you feel like your pornography that you're watching isn't benefiting your sexual life, it isn't, you don't, you know, if you're feeling lots of shame and lots of, you watch pornography, maybe you masturbate and then you kind of finish and do that, like, what am I watching? What am I viewing? What's going on? Like, and there's maybe some like disgust in self, then that's actually the piece that we want to address, because, you know, that's something that can really be worked on, because you want to be having sexual experiences with yourself, erotic experiences that are also pleasurable and enjoyable. And if we're starting to feel that pornography is being used for something else, that's something that we want to address.
In the way that we were kind of talking about it before, how it's kind of hard to pin why you might be into something, but why are people into really rough, violent sex? If it's not so much BDSM.
It's so hard to name, because like some of it can purely be because that's what's popular. That's what's pushed. That's what is on every, you know, homepage that you go to. And so that becomes quote unquote normal sex. So at what point is something rough and what point is that just what sex looks like online? There's a performative element. You know, I've worked with a lot of men in clinical practice that in that work with me, we talk about the fact that they feel like they're performing, like they feel like an actor in sex, and they have this quote unquote, you know, things they have to do that they don't actually enjoy, but they have either watched it in pornography, had discussions with friends, viewed it in media, and they go, oh, well, that's just what I should do. So they're following a script that has been built for them. And so then I think for some of them, there is that clear link of I've been watching this, I've been consuming this, and it's causing this in my personal behavior. And then for other people, there are going to be people that maybe have that enjoyment because of a degradation of women, because of a misogynistic undertone, because actually there's a fetishization and a dehumanizing of the individual, which is also a thing you should get and get some support for, because that's also not where we want to be.
Yeah. When should you be worried about your porn taste being problematic?
Two points. I think the first point is when you are worried about it. Like if you are worried about it, it doesn't need to reach a certain threshold of like intensity or violence or anything. If you're just going, actually, I'm not sure I'm loving what I'm watching and I'm not sure I'm enjoying the reactions I'm having, or even, you know, and that can be about the content. It can also be like how much pornography you're consuming, or, you know, for some people that I've worked with, the issue wasn't what they were watching, but it was the, it became that I have to do this to sleep, or I have to do this to be able to go on a date, or I have to do this to feel confident. And so, you know, what is pornography being used for? So I think that's like your first bandwidth. And then my other piece is where, when you are having those conscious thoughts of I need something more intense, if I'm needing something that is, you know, what I'm consuming is actually with the intent to harm, whether that's for the people that are in the video, whether that's the messaging that it's sending. And of course, if at any point in time, any listener is contemplating stepping into the space of getting into illegal activity of like online content, then 100% reach out for help and support.
Yeah, we're going to put some resources in the show notes as well for you listening if this is something that you're dealing with at the moment. Just quickly though, a lot of people felt really conflicted because they identified as feminists, but they were into the consensual, non-consensual, or the rough sex or the violent sex. Why is that something that some people might be into as like a woman? And what does it mean? Sorry, big question.
So we're now going to have another four-hour conversation about what does it mean to be a woman and a feminist in 2026?
Just light. Give us the light version.
Just the light version. Okay, so my first thing is it a fantasy? Is it a desire? Is it something you want to enact in real life? Is it something that is enjoyable to fantasize about? I'm going to go completely rogue right now. I know a few people, and I've had many discussions socially and just like in wider spaces, where people will be like stuck in traffic and just like zoning out and fantasizing about like, I wonder what would happen if I just like drove into a tree or off a thing. I wonder if a huge crash happened. Like, what would happen? Like, what if I got shot and this, da-da? And they do this whole like catastrophizing thing. Because we're bored and it's entertaining and like we consume media around that. None of those people want to get shot. None of them want to get into a car crash.
That's so true.
None of them want to experience any of this. It's a fantasy that is like, I'm using it for a purpose. I'm using it to pass time because it's kind of entertaining, because it's kind of like fun to have that fantasy. If you're a feminist going into a space of going, I actually really enjoy fantasizing about consensual non-consent. My other point is, what's the first word of that?
Consensual.
Yeah. The whole point, one of the biggest points that a lot of feminists, a lot of cis straight women, a lot of people enjoy consensual non-consent is because of the first word, is because it's controlled, is it's because, you know, it's one of those, I hate the phrasing that often gets pulled from it, which is like the, would they actually really want it? But the whole point of this is they do. That's actually the whole point, is that it's a way to fantasize and play with this idea of giving up control, of, you know, having an erotic experience that I'm giving myself permission to be as like wild as my brain wants to make it. That doesn't mean I actually want to go and get harmed or assaulted or any of those things. And it doesn't make you a bad feminist for being into that fantasy.
It's why we had listeners say that they really love the whole like damsel in distress, smut, like the reading of those kind of stories, like the Victorian era, like, oh my God, please, sir. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I'm an incredibly staunch intersectional feminist. I love a book about a billionaire, some billionaire guy, and like, who like they get with this person and they have like amazingly hot sex, and like she never has to work again if she doesn't want to because he's a billionaire and doesn't even matter.
So you love 50 Shades,
like,
it's great.
I have many thoughts about 50 Shades, it's great. But like that doesn't mean I don't believe in like equality of, you know, financial independence and jobs and things. Just like, fuck, it's a nice fantasy. That's like lovely to engage in a bit of just letting my brain go to this space, and also is safe to do because I know I actually still have the right to vote and have a job and have a bank account and all the things. That's, again, it's having it, having the duality of that. If you are an incredibly amazing feminist and your fantasies concern you, then go and get support for that. Go and get help, talk it through and unpack it a little bit. But also, like, my big thing around fantasy is often like, it's exactly that. It is a fantasy.
Speaking of, just lastly, what are some ways that people can deal with some of those feelings of guilt or shame about what they're into?
I think there's a couple of pieces, because it's like, are you embarrassed because you think this is something to be embarrassed about? Are you embarrassed or feeling shame because it's a harmful piece, or you feel like it's harming you in some way? And I think that's a piece you almost have to work out the difference of. If it's a harmful piece, then you probably need some external support with it, because that stuff is hard to unpack alone. If you're feeling shame because you think, oh, that's just like, people shouldn't be into that. There's so many people that are into it. Like, sexuality is so diverse. It is so unique to individuals. And this idea of, like, quote unquote normal sex is just something we made up. We made that up.
Yeah. And hopefully you've listened to The Hookup long enough to know that, like, our DMs are flooded with that. Like,
yeah.
We have an episode on literally everything. When we did this porn app, there was so much stuff that Pip and I had to Google. We're like, what the fuck is that? Like, it's just so niche, but it's so interesting.
Yeah.
Because it just shows how unique we all are.
Exactly. And, like, there is no shame in fantasizing and exploring fantasies that you decide, actually, I don't love it. Like, it might be erotic. It might, like, get me going. But actually, nah, it's not something I want to continue on with. Great. Then you know. Then you've just learned something about yourself.
What are some of those resources that people can reach out to?
If you're wanting, like, really tailored one-on-one support, then you want to do a sexologist, you want to go through either a counselor, therapist space to, like, get some really clearly targeted support. If you want to get directed to some services, obviously, Dee will put it in the show notes and all of those sort of things. Even some of the, like, Lifeline helpline spaces, like, if you're in immediate, like, feeling quite distressed maybe because you feel like you're really down a pathway and maybe you're, like, imminently about to do something that you feel use really hard to unwind or step away from, that's where those helpline supports are actually the 24-hour supports that they're there to do also. You might not think that that's the purpose, but some of them can be really great to actually go, oh yeah, in that moment, I just actually need someone on the other line of the phone to support me.
To chat. Well, thank you, Lauren. This, I know, like you said, this could go on for hours. There's so much to unpack.
But we've almost done, like, I have to come back and have a chat.
I know. We'll have to do a part two. Actually, we might get you in for Piss Play, because we had so many people that wanted to talk about that. That was a huge thing that they were into, and they were like, I want to try it in my personal life. I don't know how. So stay tuned.
In a waterproof space.
Yeah. Thank you, Lauren. This is really, really helpful.
Thanks for having me.